honestly you've heard of or even participated in computer technology such as email, instant messenger, chat rooms, Facebook, LinkedIn, MySpace, Twitter, blogging or WordPress, texting, High Five, Meetup, Live Messenger. How many of you are guilty of coming across the path of one of those? Multiple. With all the technological advancement, if you'd like a commentary on some of that, you can see Bob Cassidy. People are able to communicate 24/7 worldwide. But the question I have is, with all the new communication, are we really connecting any better? Relationally. Are we any closer to God relationally because of all of it? Are we really closer to each other relationally because of it? Is there real connection amongst all the communication? Does any of this help us love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength? Does any of this really help us love our neighbor as ourselves? Here's the truth. Communication does not equal connection. Let me say that again. Communication does not equal connection. Some have even suggested that all social media has become a new form of narcissism. Love of self. As if everybody loves to know everything about your life. Like you just sneezed and you had to put that in text. You know how many times you went to the restroom today and has to broadcast that to the millions of readers out there? Robert D. Putnam wrote a book back in 2000 called Bowling Alone. But it was Bowling Alone, the collapse and revival of American community. He shows in that book how we have become increasingly disconnected from family, friends, and neighbors. He was drawing on evidence from over 500,000 interviews. And he found that people are signing fewer petitions, belonging to fewer organizations that actually meet, that they know their neighbors less, meet with friends less frequently, and even socialize less with their families. Or even bowling alone, hence the title. More Americans are bowling now than ever, but they don't do it in leagues. They do it individually, separate from community. The song that we just listened to and saw the words of the text, I hadn't heard before the series. My son Nehemiah had mentioned it and he'd heard it on the radio. It really gripped my heart because I looked at that and I thought, that's exactly right. We go around in our world and there are millions of people we see and we just don't see them. There are people we interact with but we don't really connect with. Oh, we have lots of communication, but are we really connecting? Are we encouraging each other in the Lord and growing closer to Him through our relationship with each other? The truth is, in our day, I believe people are lonely. Even in crowds, people are lonely. Did you know the rate of suicides is double that in America from homicides? Now, there's various reasons for that. But I believe a loneliness and a disconnected from humanity is part of it. They feel that no one cares. This is a universal truth. People were made for relationship, both with God and with other people. There's both a vertical relationship with God that is necessary and a horizontal relationship with others that God intends. Now, some of you get the vertical relationship with God. You're really good at that. You pray, you read your Bible. I mean, you've got your vertical relationship going well, but what about the horizontal relationships? Listen. If your horizontal relationships primarily consist of old dead guys like John Calvin and the Puritans and Luther, and you'd rather snuggle up next to a book from a long time ago and you call that your horizontal relationship, you have missed God's intent for relationships. Some of you would consider John MacArthur or John Piper your best friend, and they don't even know who you are. I remember in seminary, and even since then, I've met guys who spend more time with Piper and Sproul and MacArthur or Swindoll than they do their own wife or children. There's a problem there. Let me encourage you to read those men. Read great authors of Christian doctrine and thought and teaching. But that is not your horizontal relationship. You need flesh and blood connection. Conversation back and forth. encouraging each other. People who can see you for who you really are, and you can see them, and you help each other grow. That is absolutely essential. So just saying, I've got my vertical relationship right, and I don't need this, I think you're missing God's plan for your life. Now, others of you are really good at the other side. I've got the horizontal thing going. I really am a people person. I love people. I just want to be around people all the time. If there's not a party, I'll just create one so that people can be around. The question I have for you is your horizontal relationships designed in such a way that you actually connect with them at a deeper level and you encourage each other to grow in God? Are your horizontal relationships helping your vertical relationship? And is your vertical relationship with God helping you in your horizontal relationships? Both are necessary. Both are required. We were created for authentic relationships, both with God and other people that God has created. Today we're going to look at Jonathan and David. I think we can learn to experience authentic community through the illustration of their lives. If you would, turn in your Bibles to 1 Samuel chapter 18 in the Old Testament. We won't be able to exposit every passage that we'll look at today, but I want to hit some highlights. What I see in the illustration of Jonathan and David's life. The first point is this: Jonathan and David model how to experience authentic community. In our first portion today, I want us to look at seven essentials for biblical community. I think they illustrate well in their lives what you and I were designed for as well. If you look at 1 Samuel chapter 18, verses 1 and 2, it says, "Now it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul," and it's speaking about David, "we're just on the heels of the story of David and Goliath." You recall the story, children? How many of you know David killed who? Goliath, big old guy. Knocked him down how? WWF wrestling? No, took the old slingshot, knocked him between the two eyes, knocked him down dead. And the fun part of the story that you typically don't share in your family devotions, he chopped his head off. I love that part. Well, we sing songs about the head being chopped off. So you're just on the heels of this 16-year-old who's come out, used of God. Saul says, "Use my armor." And David says, "That won't fit, and that's not how I fight anyway. I'm going to just fight with the power of God." He does what none of the other Israelite soldiers would do. He challenged the very large man and struck him down by the power of God. Had his five smooth stones, didn't use them all. Didn't need to. Knocked him out. So just on the heels of that, David then returns to Saul, and observing into that conversation is Saul's son, Jonathan. And that's where we pick up the story in 18. Now, it came about when David, he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. The beauty of this here is that one of the most beautiful relationships and friendships in all the scriptures, David and Jonathan, takes place not just by chance, but by God's divine orchestration here. The first point I'd get you to write down is be aware. God orchestrates circumstances and chemistry for people. Here you've got Saul, who's the king. And in the common order of things, though this is the first king for Israel, the common order of things is that Saul's son would become the next king. Why would Saul's son, Jonathan, care anything about a lowly shepherd boy? If you know anything about upper class and lower class, king's sons don't hang out with shepherd boys. Even if he was an Israelite who just killed the enemy, it's not something you'd be involved in. You would look and almost be arrogant or jealous, but never show it. Typically, someone would have the opinion of, "Oh, well, he's just showing off. I could have done it had my dad asked me." There would be competition there, but that's not what was taking place. Jonathan had a heart that was open to God's divine circumstances. David had done something, and Jonathan's like, "That's awesome." He didn't do that in his own strength. He did it because of the power of God, and he said so. He did it to defend the reputation of God and his people. And it says that Jonathan's heart was knit to David's. One of the things I find interesting is that sometimes I think we miss out on great opportunities for relationship because we have a predetermined model of who we think should be our friends, who we should connect with. Like I said, Jonathan is the son of the king. He should be the next king. So he could have just been looking around for the next queen for himself, or he could have been looking for people at about his level, people who are a little more elite in the community. But no, he was open to being friends with someone, to have his heart knit with someone who was not like him at all. I wonder if there are barriers we put up to relationships saying somebody has to be in our socioeconomic status in order to be our friend. Or they have to be a certain color before we would befriend them. Or they have to have our desires or our hobbies or whatever we put up saying, I only want to be friends with people who hunt. Or I only want to be friends with people who fish. Or I only want to be friends with people who work out or run or people who have 8 kids. I wouldn't have any friends, just one or two couples. Do we say in our own hearts and minds, I am not open to God's orchestrating of circumstances to become friends with whom He might want me to be friends with? Jonathan didn't have that barrier. When he didn't know he was going to meet David that day. But when he saw David and he saw his heart for God, he says, that's who I want to be friends with. I'm open to a man like that. He's nothing like me. I want him in my life. And God orchestrated that, knit their hearts together. It's very fascinating to me. You look at that. We think it's just natural, but it wasn't in that circumstance. It wasn't just natural. It was supernatural. A different class of people. How many relationships do we miss out on because we put barriers up that are not godly? The second thing you see in the text is to be intentional. Look at verse 3. Then Jonathan made a covenant with David, a promise, because he loved him as he loved himself. Jonathan, in verse 4, stripped himself of his robe that was on him and gave it to David. He gave his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. What in the world is Jonathan doing here? He's showing, not only am I like you, I want to show you how much I like you. I think you are going to be my friend. I want to promise you, I'm going to give you my armor. I'm going to give you my sword. Now, earlier, Saul tried to give his armor to David. David didn't accept it. Jonathan, out of love, is saying, I want to give you something. I want to be intentional. What can we do to build this friendship? And he gives away his stuff. He's the king's son. Nothing was going to be between him and a kindred spirit in the Lord. He was willing to give his things, his gifts. That was an intentional move by Jonathan to David. You know, we rarely drift into authentic community. It takes effort. It takes initiation. We have to step out sometimes. And I believe people miss opportunities for connection and the chance to build deeper relationships because they do not make themselves approachable, nor do they ever approach others. When you meet someone new, what message do you send? They don't look at me. Or is it, I want to get to know them. I want to see if there's a possibility that God may knit our hearts together. Are we open to the divine providence of God putting people in our lives? Are we approachable? And do we approach? We rarely drift into authentic community. It always takes intentionality. Even being in a small group is good, but only if we are intentional in developing deeper, authentic relationships with the people that are there. We can't just sit in a circle with smiles on and never open up with each other and have authentic community. John Benner is sitting around in a small group. He's sitting in prison right now, going through his deprogramming of whatever they're trying to deprogram him of, and it's a bunch of psycho babble. But he has to sit around in a small group and share his feelings. And he is a solid-as-a-rock Christian. And there's a lot of cycle babble going on in this little circle that's not really healing anybody because they don't have an objective source of power. They just think whatever they create. If God is a tree to them, then they all just say, great, I'm glad you have a tree God. Or if the bug crawling on the floor is your God, great, you get to worship that bug. You know, and they're all supposed to We're so proud of you. As long as it's not the real God, that's right, as Sean would profess in the true God. Sitting around in that circle is not healing anybody because there's no source of truth and there's no real opening up. It's just going through the hoops in order to get out. How many people are sitting in small groups and Sunday schools and Christian environments with a smile on and saying the things they're supposed to, but there's no real authenticity, no real genuine connection, that we just fake it till we make it? Third thing is this: be honest. Be honest. Look at chapter 19, verses 1 through 5. You'll see now Saul, and this is some time after, and David has gotten married. Fascinating story about David. You may know about his wife, Michal. He actually had the chance at a woman before that. The other daughter of Saul didn't want her, but when presented with Michal, he married her. So this time has passed. And in chapter 19, we pick up the story here. Now Saul told Jonathan, his son, and all his servants to put David to death. So Saul gathers up his people, gathers Jonathan, and says, all right, I'm sick of this boy David. What's taken place since then is David has become quite a leader and warrior. And, you know, as he would come back from battle, all the people would sing, you know, Saul has killed his thousands, David has killed his ten thousands. Oh, well, that really gets to the ego of Saul. So he's like, we need to wipe him out. I don't care how much of a blessing he has been to me. We need to get rid of him. So he tells Jonathan, because he trusts Jonathan, and he tells his servants, we need to put David to death. But Jonathan, Saul's son, greatly delighted in David. So verse 2, chapter 19 of 1 Samuel. So Jonathan told David, saying, Saul, my father is seeking to put you to death. Now therefore, please be on guard in the morning and stay in a secret place and hide yourself. I will go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. If I find anything, then I will tell you. Then Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, and said to him, do not let the king sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you, and since his deeds have been very beneficial to you. Verse 5, for he took his life in his hand and struck the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance for all Israel. You saw it and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood by putting David to death without a cause? Now, here's what I mean when I put in your notes, share the last 10%. That Jonathan, once he hears his father say that he wants David put to death, Jonathan has to make a decision. How honest is he going to be with his friend David? How honest is he going to be with his father, Saul? He hears the story. And many people will help their friends without saying the full picture. Jonathan could have gone to David and said, David, you know, you've been working real hard. You've been in all these wars. You know what? It's time to take a vacation. You know, I've got a good beach home, you know, somewhere. And take my donkey. Go out for a couple of months. Just hang out. You can come back later. Totally jumping over the truth, but putting himself in a better position that he doesn't have to confront the truth. He can get rid of David, then maybe by the time David returns from vacation, Saul will have forgotten about David and killing him. That's the truth that Jonathan has in his mind. What am I going to do with this? But Jonathan doesn't do that. He goes right to David and tells him the truth. And he confronts his father with the truth. Dad, he has helped you. He's done it all. He's confronting his father and saying, why would you do this? He went all the way with the truth on both sides. It's a major risk. A risk of potential loss of relationship. Potential loss of his own position. Dad could have turned on him and said, fine, I will kill David and you, Jonathan. I don't think Saul was above that. That to be honest, you want to do a study on insecurity, by the way? Just read the life of Saul. He was a very insecure man. He started out fairly well. But quickly, insecurity and fear and jealousy took over. Here's the truth about insecure people. They will always have a hard time connecting with relationally with others. Insecure people never open up and want to connect with others. They're always fearful and jealous. Jonathan was honest with his friend David. He was honest with his father Saul. He put his life and relationships on the line with honesty. Most people that I know are fairly honest with the first 90% of the information they have. But it's the last 10% of truth that is more difficult for us to share. We'll deal with the things that are easy, but when you get to that truth that if I share this, it could cost me my relationship with this person. It could pain them in such a way that they will reject me. Now, I share it in love, but it will be uncomfortable. It's something they need to hear. It might be the big elephant in the room that everybody's talking about or thinking about, but no one's ever told this person the very thing they need to hear. And it's very difficult, and most of you never get to that point of sharing. It's one of the most difficult things I have to do in the pastorate. When I see, you know, and I love you guys, and I'll see things in your life, and I'm the one, everybody says, well, why don't you talk to them? And I'm not afraid to talk. I don't like confrontation. I don't like get up in the morning going, who can I confront today? But there are times I just have to go that extra 10% and say, you know what you're doing is wrong. It's not working for you. Other people are talking about it, but you need to hear this. And I know this may pain you, but let me tell you, this is the truth. If you have somebody in your life who's willing to tell you the truth and still love you, you have a great friend. If you've got a bunch of people who will never tell you that there's something wrong, or you know, you got the green bee stuck in your tooth, or your hair's a mess, or maybe the way you're walking in your life, everybody's talking about it, but nobody's saying anything, and you don't see it, but they come and tell you, not to beat you up, but to build you up, you have a good friend. You need some friends who are willing to go that extra 10% to say the truth. Jonathan was willing to say the truth to David and say the truth to his father at the risk of losing the relationships that he had. Proverbs 27, verse 5 and 6 says, better is open rebuke than love that is concealed. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but deceitful are the kisses of an enemy. Here's a third thing. Be available. Be available. When crisis comes, real friends arrive. Skipping over to chapter 20. In chapter 19, the deal between Saul and David ends up kind of working itself out. God doesn't have it as the time for Saul to go full-fledged yet against David, but he was going to work up to that. So by the time chapter 20 hits, and Saul is full-fledged, coming after David, wants to kill him, David flees. You see in verse 1 of chapter 20. Then David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came and said to Jonathan, what have I done? What is my iniquity and what is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life? Now notice this. David flees, goes somewhere else, and who does he run into? His friend Jonathan. Is that just Jonathan's hangout spot? David just happened to run away to the very spot Jonathan was on vacation? No. As he was fleeing, his friend cared enough to show up in the difficult places, to be there for him. You know, real friends are the ones who show up in the midst of crisis. You know, they arrive. They come because they care. Now, look at what happens in the conversation. It really shows Jonathan's heart and his friendship with David. David's running for his life. He's wondering, what have I done? Why is your father after me? Verse 2, he said to him, talking about Jonathan saying to David, far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing either great or small without disclosing it to me. And that has been the past. If Saul was going to do something to David, he would have said it to Jonathan. Jonathan wasn't aware of this new attempt to kill David. He says, surely my father's not going to do this. He would have told me. So why should my father hide this thing from me, saying, it is not so. So David challenges the perceptive truth that Jonathan has. David has to say it very clearly to Jonathan. David, in verse 3, yet David vowed again. He promised. He says, I'm telling the truth. Your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight, and he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death. Jonathan is standing between two versions of a story. David says, your dad's trying to kill me. But in Jonathan's perception, dad would have told me that. When there's two versions of the story, your friend has told you one, and your perception or what you believe that your father has led you to believe, which do you choose? When you're standing there before your friend, which story will you believe? Which will you trust? Put you in a difficult circumstance. David had never lied to Jonathan before. And Saul did have a reputation now of having ill feelings towards David. Jonathan chose to trust his friend. That's a real friend, isn't it? You ever been questioned by a friend about a story and there's two or three or four versions of something and you knew you were telling the truth, but the friend had to decide whether they could trust you or not? Real friends show up. Real friends trust you. Just as a side note, if you ever lie to your friend that you've had trust with, it is very difficult to rebuild that trust. If they ever find that you were just lying, that you misrepresented yourself, it's very difficult to get back. So hold that sacred trust of truth with your friends at all times, with your spouse, with your children. Trust broken is hard to mend. It can be mended, but it's very difficult. So you get that the story here. What does Jonathan decide to do? Verse 4 of chapter 20. Then Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do for you." At the point of crisis, at the point of contention between two different versions of a story, Jonathan says, "I will trust your word." Proverbs 17, verse 17 says, "A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity." Oh Lord, how we need true friends who will love at all times. Be loyal is the fifth thing here. Be loyal. Don't shrink back when things heat up. So now the heat is going to happen. Verse 5, following the very time that Jonathan says, "Fine, I'll trust you, whatever you say." Verse 5, "So David said to Jonathan, 'Behold, tomorrow is the new moon.'" It's a new moon festival. "And I ought to be sitting down to eat with the king. But let me go, that I may hide myself in the field until the third evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, 'David earnestly asked to leave of me to run to Bethlehem, his city, because it is the yearly sacrifice there for the whole family.' If he says, 'It is good,'" saying, you know, if Saul says, "Oh, that's fine, your servant will be safe," David says. "But if he is angry, very angry, know that he has decided on evil." So they set up this plan during the new moon festival. All right, if David's supposed to be with the king and he doesn't arrive and the king is fine about that, then everything will be fine. But if the king gets very upset, he's going to kill him. His heart is evil. It's a way to show Jonathan truly the heart of his father. And so they set the whole thing up. They're going to end up finding out that the father was very angry, and that Jonathan was going to have to communicate with David, letting him know what the father's response was. And it was basically the shooting of the arrows. He has a servant. He says, "Let's go do target practice. I'll shoot him out there. If I shoot short, I'll yell out, 'Oh, it's on this side,' meaning to David, 'It's okay. Come back home. Everything's fine.' If I shoot farther and I say out, 'No,' to the servant, 'It's farther out. It's just beyond,' then it means, 'David, you're going to have to escape. My father's coming after you.'" So they set up this design, this mechanism that they can understand each other. Understand that when Jonathan is in the home, I am sure he's praying that his father will be in a good mood and that his father has forgotten all ill will towards David. Because it's difficult knowing that you may lose your relationship with your father and your respect for him, and you may never see your friend again. It's a very difficult time for Jonathan. Look down at verse 13 of chapter 20. It says, "If it please my father to do you harm, if I find out that my father wants to do you harm, may the Lord do so, that harm, to me, to Jonathan. And more also, if I do not make it known to you and send you away, that you may go in safety. And may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father." Jonathan is the heir of the throne. If David were to be killed, it would remove all competition to that next position. He is the rightful heir, but he loves David. And his father, who has chosen to execute, to go and assassinate David, Jonathan has to choose, where is my loyalty? Is it with my Father? Is it with the throne? Or is it with my friend? Do you understand the kind of pressure that may put us under if we were in that type of position? From a comfortable chair in an air-conditioned room, we could probably say, oh, we would have done the right thing. But what would you have done with all the pressures of the kingdom on his shoulders? He had to choose where his loyalty was the highest. This is where friendships and relationships fail to make it. When times get difficult, we either see the light or we feel the heat and give in. Authentic relationships are those who remain loyal for the glory of God. Jonathan saw in the life of David that God's hand was upon him. The next was be vulnerable. Refuse to let fear or pride limit your relationships. Of course, David is going to run. The whole mechanism of telling David what the father's response was has been made known. Look down at verse 40. It says, then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, go, bring them to the city. Verse 41, then when the lad was gone, David rose up from the south side and fell on his face to the ground. David bowed three times. And Jonathan and David kissed each other and wept together, but David wept more. You see the anguish in their hearts, but the vulnerability to show their friend their entire emotional state. They cried, they kissed, they wept together, they shared joy and sorrow through the years, they shared their celebration and now grief. Listen to me, those who refuse to share emotions, whether joy or sorrow, with others, are roadblocking the deep level of love that is possible. A real friend is one who hears and understands you when you share your deepest feelings. He supports you when you are struggling. He corrects you gently with love when needed. And he forgives you when you fail. A true friend prods you to personal growth, stretches you in your full potential, and most of all celebrates your successes as if it were his own. What good, and I'll challenge some of you here, I know, because this is a struggle for you. What good is an emotionless relationship? I'm not saying we ought to all be wimpy and crying and get all gushy, because the women get that pretty well, but the men, we're like, hey, we're friends, we go sit at a ball game together. You have a good time? Yeah, what'd you talk about? Nothing. I mean, we just have a good time just hanging out, you know. We're not all emotional, I understand that, and I'm not advocating that. What I am advocating is, are you ever real? Men have feelings too. Do we always put up that barrier and never express that? David and Jonathan were at a deep level of their intimacy that they could express everything that was on their heart. I think some people hesitate to be vulnerable because they're self-centered and egotistical. Hear my understanding of this. People who are self-centered and self-serving always have a hard time getting along with others, and they will never connect. Not because they necessarily think too highly of themselves, but that they think too lowly of other people. And they would never want to express their emotion to someone of that state. They'll never be vulnerable with somebody less than them. When was the last time you told your friend, I love you? I didn't grow up in an environment where we said, I love you. It wasn't part of my family vocabulary. So it was odd to begin that kind of conversation when I was married. Kind of like, do I love you? Yeah, I'm still here, aren't I? But now we say that all the time. I'll tell my kids 10 to 15 times a day. And if you multiply that by 8, you know that's a lot of I love yous. But it's true. I want it to be known through my words and my actions. I love it when I'm with certain friends on the phone. And at the end, we don't say bye. We just say, I love you, man. Talk to you later. It's a true love. Do you have people you can say that with? Last thing here is be spiritual. Help others grow every day in every way to become basically an R12 Christian, the principles of God. Flipping over to 1 Samuel chapter 23, verse 15 through 18, you see that their whole relationship is built on the spiritual connection with God. 1 Samuel chapter 23, verse 15. Now David became aware that Saul had come to seek his life while David was in the wilderness of Ziph at Horesh. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David at Horesh and encouraged him in God. He didn't just go to him and say, well, I love you and our friendship is going to help you along the way. No, he encouraged him in God. Thus, he said to him, do not be afraid, because the hand of Saul, my father, will not find you. And you, this is the son of the king saying to David, you will be king over Israel, and I will be next to you. And Saul, my father, knows that also. Verse 18 then, so the two of them, David and Jonathan, made a covenant before the Lord. And David stayed at Horesh while Jonathan went to his house. He came to encourage him in the Lord and saying, you know what? Let's make a covenant between you and me and the Lord. You're going to be the next leader. God has selected you. It's all about the glory of God and what He wants, and I want to be right there to help that along. Anything I can do, because our relationship is not built on just our mutual love for each other. It was designed by God. God put us together. And God will sustain us, and God has a plan for us, and we are in relationship in order to help us grow more in love with Him. That is why we have relationships. You know, in Proverbs 27:17, iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. What is the sharpening? It is that we'd be sharpened to be more Christ-like, like God. We need each other so that we can grow closer to God. There are no Lone Ranger Christians in the world. We need each other. We need to pray for each other. We need to pray with each other. We can share a verse of encouragement. But basically, we just need to be Christ-centered for and with each other. Let me give you the last two things. So if David and Jonathan are the model for this, I think David and Jonathan's covenant with God was the basis for their devotion to one another. Their vertical relationship with God provided the best horizontal relationship with each other. And likewise, I believe that the horizontal relationship with each other provided the best vertical relationship with God. Both were necessary. Both were required. The third thing is this. Jonathan and David's relationship reveals that authentic community occurs when the real you meets real needs for the right reason, in the right way. Our key verse out of Romans is this. In Romans chapter 12, verse 9, we'll put up on the screen. Would you read this with me out loud? Let love be without hypocrisy. That means to be humble. Just be who you are. Be real and vulnerable with people. Read the next part. What is evil? Cling to what is good. This is speaking of the fellow believers. There are good things in each other, and there are things in us that are evil. And it takes community to work that out. So abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. We need to be honest with each other. Read the next part. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. Obviously, to be devoted. The next part. Give preference to one another in honor. Oh, is that not to honor each other? Do we need to not think of ourselves more highly than we ought? Not to think too lowly of ourselves than we ought? Let's just not think of ourselves at all and just think of God, what God will do with us together. Not lagging. Let's go ahead and read it. Not lagging behind in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, persevering in tribulation, devoted to prayer, contributing to the needs of the saints, practicing hospitality. What if you just put, What if you put together at the end, right before the comma every time, rejoicing in hope together, persevering in tribulation together, devoted to prayer together, contributing to the needs of the saints together, practicing hospitality together. The Christian life was never meant to be lived alone. We do things together. Key thought today is this. Authentic community is the core of Christianity. It's not intellect. It's not financial. It is not physical. It's authentic community. And that authentic community is with God and with each other. When we looked at the beginning of our series here in the second week of September, we looked at John chapter 17. So let me just take one verse out of that section. Verse 21. That all of them may be one. Jesus is praying for His people. That all of them may be one, unified, together. Father, just as You are in me and I am in You. We are together. I want them to be together. So that may they also be in us. Together, unified, authentic community, so that the world may believe that You have sent me. This is in your notes, but let me give you just three thoughts. There are three types of people you must have in your life if you're going to grow. Three. One, and this takes a heart of humiliation, being humble. You need a person in your life that's better than you. Someone who's farther down the road than you. Someone who can show you the way. Someone who's willing to invest in your life and you can learn from them. Being humble to receive what they have to say. You've got to have that. You also have to have a heart of vulnerability, that you have somebody who walks along the way with you, that grows with you, that's right where you are. Oftentimes that is your spouse. And there are other brothers or sisters in Christ there. But you need someone ahead of you. You need somebody with you. And you also need to have a heart of generosity. There are people not yet arrived where you are. And you need to have patience. And you need to give. Help them see where they haven't been yet. That you're a little farther than they are. And it's not out of arrogance and pride, but it's out of generosity. Man, I've been where you are and I want to help you along. Those kind of relationships, if you have all three of those, someone who's ahead of you, someone who's with you, and someone who's behind you, you will grow in the Christian life. Some of us aren't growing because we don't have those kind of people in our life. We're doing things alone. We don't want anybody ahead of us because it makes us jealous. We don't want anybody behind us because it takes patience. We just got people with us, and then we get frustrated with them because they're just as awful as we are. You see the problem here? Find somebody. Couples, find somebody. Couples that are ahead of you. Couples that are behind you. Take someone with you. I remember talking to a man when we first started our church, and we were talking about family devotions. I said, teach your kids the Bible. And he says, I don't know much of the Bible. I said, great. Get a children's Bible and read one story ahead. So you'll know just a little more than they do. And they won't pick it up that you don't know much. You're taking them along just one step ahead. That's all you need. The application, those three, get connected in a spiritually positive relational environment. You need to be aware. You need to be intentional. You need to go deeper with one or two people in your group. You're sitting around a small group. Maybe you got 10 or 12 in your small group. You're beginning to make some connections with people, one or two of them. Get offline. Go to have coffee. Go have lunch together. Develop intentionally some relationships in your small group. And share and pray about a significant struggle or fear in your life with a safe person. That takes vulnerability and spirituality. If you want to grow and you want to see others grow, then you need to have strong relationships.